Blog Talk Radio.
Tribune is important because they are the ones that gave Lincoln his presidential push. When the Republican Party, the new Republican Party, had met in Chicago, and Chicago had more political conventions of both parties than any other city, back in 1861, the reason Lincoln got nominated was Joseph Medill hired the loudest, deepest voices that he could find, and they were stationed strategically in the old Chicago Coliseum, which is the nearest south side, incidentally located where Capone used to have his warehouses 50 years later. Anyway, they kept bellowing throughout the hall, Lincoln, Lincoln, Abe Lincoln, and this is how Lincoln nominated to get the first Republican Party nomination for president. And of course, the Chicago Tribune, saying history, under Robert McCormick, the descendant of Joseph Medill, the Tribune had the largest daily circulation in America, more than the New York Times, more than the Los Angeles Times. Although the fact that one of the political fictions in American folklore, if you want to call it that, is that the Jews, or people of Jewish heritage, control all the media. That's not true. McCormick's and Medill were Presbyterians. The people, the Chandlers, who started and ran the Los Angeles Times, were Southern Confederates, Protestants. We've had other papers. We had the McClatchy chain. They were Protestant. And of course, we had the New York Times, which was started by German Jewish heritage people from Tennessee, the Salzburgers. And they, I don't know if they practiced, but they certainly didn't defend the rights of Jews for being persecuted and placed in concentration camps. Adolf Hitler and Hitler and Ackroyd. Also, another paper of Jewish heritage is the San Francisco Chronicle, started by two Dutch Jews, the De Young brothers. I don't know if they practice. The Philadelphia Inquirer, was Walter Annenberg. He may have converted. It was another Jewish news. The USA Today, Neuberger, Newhart, excuse me. I think the one other paper had a Jewish heritage background. But anyway, and then of course we have the major electronic media, RCA, NBC, David Sarnoff, CBS, Walter Paley. He was actually from Chicago, and he anglicized his name from Pilevsky. He made his money in cigars and changed it to Paley, married a woman, Episcopalian background, who was called Babe. ABC, Goldenson. So all we, and then, of course, we had a heavy influx of Jewish heritage people in PBS. But there's been quite a mix, and so. But the Chicago Tribune was under Robert McCormick. He was there for about 55 years. He served in World War I, and that's what he got his title, the Colonel. And he was on I think General Pershing's staff, and at the famous Battle of Catigny in France. After the war, he set up an estate in the western suburbs of Chicago. And brought a lot of the World War One and military equipment and memorabilia to that. If you ever get to Chicago and you're interested in military history, you should go out to Catigny and visit and see all the wonderful things that McCormick tried to do. Now, he was also a brilliant businessman. He used his Canadian connections to get paper mill from Canada, and this brought it down from through Lake Michigan, and did his printing off the Chicago River at the Tribune's headquarters. He was one of the first ones to do this. He also saw the advantage of radio. He bought WGN Radio, which we will hear an excerpt when they opened their new studios. He also WGN later went into TV. He bought set up a radio station in Nova Scotia, where his ancestors came from, and they were to relay broadcasts and news from Europe. He also had one of the first correspondents to go to Europe from the Midwest. His cousin, Patterson, set up the New York Daily News. It was quite a family. And, of course, the money was one of the McCormicks was the inventor of the Reaper. Just before the Civil War. So it's quite a bit of history there. We're going to open with Robert McCormick's introduction and his inauguration of the new studios of WGN in Chicago. Let me get that right now. What happened to it here? We just brought it in, uploaded it. Had a little problem this morning with, excuse me, where the heck is he? Here we go. Here is Colonel McCormick.
Ladies and gentlemen, from WGN's auditorium studio, we switch you to the scene of our new building ceremony. Go ahead, Lee Bennett at Illinois and St. Clair Streets.
Thank you very much, John Mello, and good afternoon from a scene of great activity. Right before us here at Illinois and St. Clair Streets, preparations are being made for the digging of the huge pit for the first caisson upon which will rest a block-long addition to WGN and Tribune Tower. Here to take part in this significant ceremony is the man who has made this great undertaking possible, a man whose first thought has always been toward progress and ever-increasing service to the people of America and the Midwest. It is our proud privilege to introduce Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune and president of WGN Chicago, serving the Middle West. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick.
As excavation preparations are just about complete for the first caisson for this new building, our thoughts naturally look ahead toward tomorrow's world of radio, facsimile, FM, television, and newspaper service, which this undertaking portends. But quite understandably, our thoughts also travel backward, delving into that hectic past out of which had risen Tribune Tower and the WGN building as we know them today, and out of which will rise this new addition, which we will know tomorrow. That eventful past starts nearly 100 years ago, on June 10th, 1847. was it on that day that the Chicago Tribune was founded? The year 1847 marked more than the beginning of the Chicago Tribune. It was a year of numerous historical beginnings. Chicago was at the dawn of a new commercial and political era. The great new region west of the Alleghenies, something different from that part of the nation formed by the 13 colonies, was on the march. And Chicago was becoming its dynamic expression. This expression took the form of the creative mind. A free people set to work to make the dream of the human race come true. The first railroad was at hand. The telegraph outposts were near. The Illinois-Michigan Canal was about ready. Gas lights were around the corner. Plank roads were bringing the city out of the mud. The first stockyards had come, and the manufactured reefer. At this stage of creation, the first issue of the Chicago Tribune was launched. 400 copies printed in a small frame building at the corner of Lake and LaSalle Street. And as Chicago grew, the Tribune grew. Larger quarters were found over Gary's grocery store at the corner of Lake and Randolph Street. Then, one spring morning in 1855, a young editor with reddish hair and a spare figure walked into the Tribune office. And thereafter, the paper's history was largely of his making. This man was Jodis Medill, and for his entire lifetime, he became the dominant figure of the Tribune in the Midwest. Through the Tribune, it was Medill who supported Abraham Lincoln and the sound American politics for which he stood. It was Medill whose fine character and outspoken American principles were reflected in every column of the paper's makeup. It was Medill who brought the paper through trying days of the Civil War and established the Tribune as the true voice of the Middle West. Sparing no effort or expense to serve the dynamic community with which it had grown. As Chicago and the Tribune grew, more and more space was needed in order to provide this ever-increasing service. And after moving from building to building, one of the world's finest newspaper plants was erected on Michigan Avenue in 1924. The building we know today is Tribune Tower. In the meantime, the Tribune Company had acquired station WGN, which was operated from leased studios at the Drake Hotel. As radio grew, it was apparent that this means of communication was to become an equally important service to the community as newspaper communication. The Tribune and station WGN have worked hand in hand in serving this community with radio, became such an important factor that additional quarters were soon needed for the Tribune's new child. So it was that one of the nation's finest broadcasting plants was erected next to the Tribune Tower in 1935. This building is familiar to all Chicagoans today as the home of WGN. This afternoon, WGN and the Tribune, carrying on the tireless service of Jodis Medill, again work hand in hand to provide even greater service to the community with which these organizations have grown. As we are about to begin work on the first caisson, which will rest on bedrock, we are reminded that Chicago and the Midwest are still expanding, and WGN and the Tribune will always expand too. Expand with the city and community with which we have grown by serving for more than 98 eventful years. The spirit of Jodis Medill is still with us, and our eyes are turned as his were always turned towards the future and the welfare of our beloved city and community, Chicago and the Midwest.
Thank you very much, Colonel McCormick.
Now, that was Colonel McCormick when they did the digging. All that noise you heard in the background was the construction attractions. Now, there's another side to the Chicago Tribune that has to be talked about. One of their reporters during the Al Capone period was a guy named Jake Lingle, L-I-N-G-L-E. Coincidentally, the name of the former governor of Hawaii, Linda Lingle, and some people think she may not only be, some people have raised the issue, was she a lesbian? Not only that, was she more importantly related to Jake Lingle? Now, Jake Lingle never wrote anything for the Chicago Tribune. He was on the payroll, but what people didn't know that he was also on the payroll for bribes from Al Capone. He betrayed Al Capone, and Jake Lingle was shot in the Illinois Central Station while waiting for going to the racetrack. This is accurately depicted in the film Al Capone, starring Rod Steiger and Martin Balsam. Martin Balsam played Jake Lingle, although they didn't use his name. Jake Lingle is buried in Mount Carmel, a Roman Catholic cemetery in western suburbs of Chicago, DuPage County, I believe. And also that is the burial ground for the cardinal, archbishops, and priests, and bishops of the Chicago Roman Catholic Archdiocese. And Al Capone is also buried there. Another interesting thing about the Chicago Tribune in the 1948 elections, this is our presidential anecdote for today, they printed a headline, they jumped the gun and printed a headline that Tom Dewey, the Republican nominee for president, and against Harry Truman, who was the sitting, who had succeeded FDR, they printed the infamous headline, Dewey beats Truman. They were grossly incorrect. They were grossly wrong. And there was also a famous radio commentator named H.B. Kaltenborn. And it's very interesting. Harry Truman used to mimic him. And there's this famous picture, and we have it here on the Blog Talk page for today. Harry Truman holding up the Chicago Tribune. Great error. Dewey beats Truman, when in fact Harry Truman won that 1948 election. He did not run for re-election in his own right in 1952 when General Dwight Eisenhower, who was supported by the Chicago Tribune, ran successfully for president against Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, whom I met and knew when I worked in the federal courthouse in Chicago many, many years ago. The Chicago Tribune was also known as Rib Rock. Now, if you attend a convention in Chicago, McCormick Place is named after Colonel Robert McCormick. Now, this is how this happened. Richard Daley was an enemy of the Chicago Tribune. Robert McCormick died in 1955, and that was the year that Richard Daley, first time he ran, Richard Daley the first, ran for mayor of Chicago. And he had a famous and infamous police scandal called the Summerdale Scandal, one of the worst political and police scandals in American history. We'll get into that another day. Anyway, they needed a new convention hall, and they had this big empty space on the lakefront. But the Chicago Tribune would have opposed it because of the expenditure of money. They were fiscally conservative. So Richard Daley got the bright idea, let's name it after the late head editor, publisher of the Chicago Tribune, Robert McCormick. And that's where the name McCormick Place comes from. We'll play another interview or speech from Robert McCormick, fantastic man, one of the greatest newsmen, even if you disagree with his politics and his editorials, but he's still one of the greatest innovators in American media. I won't call him an innovator. He was a guy who was born nearly blind, and he worked as a longshoreman with his hands on the San Francisco waterfront, Eric Hoffer. Now, we, part of our archives, we have several interviews that he did, and we're going to play part two because it's very relevant to what's going on with Occupy America, these radical leftists, these pseudo-political philosophers. And I think it's very important that what Eric Hoffer died in 1983 or 84, I think, and what he said is very relevant to today, to things that we think are just new, but they're not, because history goes full cycle, and we've come full cycle with many of the things that films, which you're going to play excerpts from, talking about depicting the political events back in the 50s, the 40s, have come back to haunt us in the worst possible way. And so we're going to be playing excerpts from these films because we have them in our archives, and these are educational projects. We're going to play this Eric Hoffer Part 2 interview. Where is Eric? He's having a slight problem here. It's part one. Here we go. Part two. Eric Hoffer, the author, philosopher.
Ladies and gentlemen, from WGN's auditorium studio, we switch you to the scene of our new building. Ladies and gentlemen, from
By my time of life, one has accumulated more allegiances and moral debts than the mind can remember or the heart contain. So I cannot enumerate my betters, my mentors, and sustainers during so many years of trying to use with sense this communications instrument as unperfected as the persons who use it. But they know that I know who they are. Many are gone, including the man who invented me, Ed Murrow. Some died in the wars we were reporting. I've gone the normal span of a man's working life, rather abnormal in this calling, and it's a happy surprise. We were like a young band of brothers in those early radio days with Murrow. If my affections are not easily given, neither are they easily withdrawn. I have remained through it all with CBS News, and if it is regarded as old-fashioned to feel loyalty to an organization, so be it. Mine has been here an unelected, unlicensed, uncodified office and function. The rules are self-imposed. These were a few. Not to underestimate the intelligence of the audience and not to overestimate its information. To elucidate when one can, more than to advocate. To remember always that the public is only people and people only persons, no two alike. To retain the courage of one's doubts as well as one's convictions in this world of dangerously passionate certainties. To comfort oneself in times of error, the knowledge that the saving grace of the press, print, or broadcast is its self-correcting nature. And remember that ignorant and biased reporting has its counterpart in ignorant and biased reading and listening. We do not speak into an intellectual or emotional void. One's influence cannot be measured. History provides for the journalist no markers or milestones, but he is allowed to take his memories. And one can understand as he looks back the purpose of the effort and why it must be done. A friend and teacher, the late Walter Lippmann, described the role of the professional reporter and observer of the news in this manner. "We make it our business," he said, "to find out what is going on under the surface and beyond the horizon, to infer, to deduce, to imagine, and to guess what is going on inside, and what this meant yesterday and what it could mean tomorrow. In this way, we do what every sovereign citizen is supposed to do, but has not the time or the interest to do it for himself. This is our job. It is no mean calling, and we have a right to be proud of it and to be glad that it is our work." In the end, of course, it is not one's employers or colleagues that sustain one quite so much as the listening public, when it be so minded. And I have found that it applies only one consistent test, not agreement with one on substance, but the perception of honesty and fair intent. There is in the American people a tough, undiminished instinct for what is fair. Rightly or wrongly, I have the feeling that I have passed that test. I shall wear this like a medal. Millions have listened intently and indifferently, in agreement and in powerful disagreement. Tens of thousands have written their thoughts to me. I will feel always that I stand in their midst. This was Eric Severide in Washington. Thank you and goodbye.
Eric's not retiring from television entirely, but only from daily journalism, and that means, of course, this broadcast. It's not only his beautifully chosen words of wisdom that we shall miss. To this newsman, he's one of the finest essayists of the century. But we shall also miss our almost daily contacts with him in the pursuit of our craft, in which his rare insight and unswerving integrity were a constant source of professional guidance. And yes, it's also true that we shall be the poorer in our self-esteem for no longer being able to call him colleague. But that's the way it is. Wednesday, November 30th, 1977. This is Walter Cronkite, CBS News. Good night.
Well, we had to substitute that interview, that commentary by Eric Severide, who also interviewed Eric Hopper. There was a slip-up. We're dealing with nearly 2,000 audio and visual tapes, discs. And I apologize for the mistake. We'll play part two of the Eric Hopper interview on Monday. Among the political fictions that are going on today is a statement by San Francisco's mayor that gay marriage, if I'm quoting him correctly, is a San Francisco value, or he alluded to it. That's not true. According to the University of California, Los Angeles, their college, law school college, about 15% of San Francisco's population are involved in gay lesbian marriages. It is also estimated that about 100 out of a population of 800,000 approximately, there are about 150,000, 160,000 gay, lesbian voters. That's hardly a majority. George Christopher, San Francisco's late great mayor, probably the greatest, said it best that San Francisco, the values in San Francisco are tolerance. We don't see that anymore in this city. Where there was once friendship, fun, and fraternity, there's now fear, loathing, and contempt for these people, these beggars who have come here, to come to California to do what they couldn't do back east because it wouldn't be tolerated and they wouldn't get away with it. So they come out here and think we're all stupid and naive, and we're going to allow ourselves to be intimidated and our children to be buggered. Where there was once tolerance, there is now tyranny. This phony hate crimes law is designed to intimidate people who don't agree with the political power, political beings that are in power. So what we say is, hey, gay marriage should be something that is left to the churches who want to perform them. The Roman Catholic Church has been trash. People have come in there and spilled blood on while there was a service. Of course, that's not a hate crime. Had it been a mosque or a Jewish synagogue or a Black Baptist church, I wonder how the authorities would have responded to that. But it seems that the only hate crime applies, like Hitler said, to those who oppose the new order. And it's time that we stand up, speak out, stand firm, and not be moved by the bullies, the buggerers, the BS artists that are currently in power. All power is transitory. As I used to say, every dog has its day until it comes time to euthanize it. And we see that coming with this growing group of non-accountable people who are currently holding the reins of power, however weakly they're holding it, because they're slipping away. The money's not there for these agendas. People are beginning to ask questions about accountability, the lack of accountability, and the qualifications of the people dispensing this money and asking for more taxpayers' money and for projects that we don't need and shouldn't even be thinking about. Anyway, we will be back Monday, and we will have the part two of the Eric Coffer interview, very important, and we'll have some updated stuff. And we'll try to get, we're going to be covering interviews on the subject that so affects our lives, but is the least covered in both the alternative and the corporate media, and that is the legal constituency in our lives, the courts, the lawyers, the policies that are being promoted, the cases that are being decided, things that are being covered up, the cases that are being tampered with, like the Steve Neri case, U.S. Navy case has been going on for 16 years, and hopefully we can put an end to it and he will get justice, as well as the other military personnel whose abuses have been covered up by the morons in the media. Anyway, this is Peter Paul Fazilla, and we will end with our usual politics and poker, and it'll be interesting to see who Romney decides when he gets back from his trip, who he's going to, or who the Republican Party is going to nominate as their vice presidential candidate. Here we go. Maybe they should sit down and play some poker.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Okay, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Five.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
We're gonna have to pick more than congressional candidates. Something's wrong with the tape. This is Peter Paul Brazola. We will be back Monday at 4 o'clock. Good night.